Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the search for minerals is leading some corporations to begin mining the ocean floor. But scientists warn that this could devastate fragile ecosystems and will have repercussions that we still don't understand. What is going on in the deep sea? And first,
since the 2020 election, Republican state legislators have passed a series of laws intended to decrease the number of eligible voters in future elections. What are the legal implications, and what does this mean for the future of American democracy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the 2020 election, the Republican Party has confronted defeat by claiming the election was stolen. In response, state legislatures controlled by the party have written substantial revisions to election processes and election law. In the name of protections against fraud, these appear to be intended to restrict the pool of eligible voters. This campaign of voter suppression has significant implications on democratization, majority rule, and in particular voter access in communities historically underrepresented via voter suppression here in the United States. On today's show, we will examine this campaign, the legal implications, as well as the political implications. Our guests are Nicholas Stephanopoulos. He is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He is the author of The New Vote Dilution, Election Litigation in the Time of the Pandemic and Depoliticizing Redistricting. And Kimberly Whaley. She is the Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She is the author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why and How to Read the Constitution and Why. Thank you both very much. Nicholas Stephanopoulos, I'll start with you. Since so much at the core of this is who gets to vote, who gets to make that determination?
Yep. Thanks a lot for having me on this program. It's really a pleasure. So, you know, American government is complicated, and that complexity extends to elections and to determining what the rules are for elections. So there's no single actor who gets to make the call as to electoral rules. It's the product of the choices of a number of different actors. So first off, states have the presumptive default authority to set electoral regulations for state and federal elections. Then Congress has a role, especially with respect to federal elections. Congress can enact essentially whatever policies it wants at the federal electoral level. And then the courts are also involved. Under the Constitution, there's a right to vote. And so if courts conclude that certain electoral rules overly burden voting, then courts might strike down those rules. There are also doctrines under the Constitution and under statute about racial discrimination in voting. And so if courts conclude that electoral rules have a racially discriminatory purpose or a racially disparate impact, that can also be enough to invalidate the rules. And so the rules that we get are the product of the intricate interplay between state governments, the federal government, and the courts via litigation.
And Kimberly Whaley, I know it's been described frequently that the U.S. doesn't really have one federal election. They have 50 state elections on federal office. How accurate is that as a description?
Well, you could actually move that number up because a lot of elections happen at even, you know, more local jurisdictions. So there are actually thousands of sets of rules and different ballots. And that does create sort of this patchwork system where even though the Supreme Court has recognized implicit in the original constitutional right to vote, there's actually the original document doesn't affirmatively have a right to vote the way, say, there's a right to free speech, which I think does get tricky and makes problems, frankly, when it gets into the court system, because the court's not required to value the right to vote in the same way that it values other things. Certainly, we're in a system where, you know, if you live in Oregon, your access to the ballot, you can walk in same day, register and vote in that moment, is really different from, say, Texas, which is, some experts have said, is the most restrictive state in the union for voting, but certainly many places where you can't walk in. And there's a bunch of hoops that you have to jump through in order in order to access the franchise. And interesting sort of historical component of this, and which distinguishes us from other democracies, is that we are an opt-in system. You have to prove your eligibility to vote. And that dates back to just, you know, white male landowners originally having access to the ballot. We're still having a debate in this country whether the right people, that is, people that we find acceptable for voting, so to speak, should have access, even if there's a constitutional right. Whereas in other countries, it's an opt-out. You're born in the hospital here, you get your Social Security card, maybe you'd get your voter registration card too at some point automatically. And then you'd have to decide, no, I don't want to participate. And because we're an opt-in system, the numbers are very low, and we're still having this fight for the right. And people who believe, a lot of people think their right to vote doesn't matter. And I always point back to the fact that we're continuing to have this debate about voter access. If your right didn't matter, people wouldn't be trying so hard to limit access to the ballot. And as you indicated in the lead, that's exactly what's happening across the country for a number of reasons.
Nicholas, there's a historical context to this, both what Kimberly said was, you know, the opt-in versus opt-out, and the fact that we have a relatively low percentage of eligible voters compared to other democracies. And it's fair to say that not every community has been treated equally with a determination as to who are the eligible voters. Can you talk a bit about some of the history of who's allowed to opt-in?
Sure, right. So when American democracy began, the circle of eligible voters was quite small. White men who own property. And one of the themes of the history of American democracy is the steady widening of that circle. So before the Civil War, property requirements for voting largely disappear. After the Civil War, the 15th Amendment ends disenfranchisement based on, or it's supposed to end disenfranchisement based on race. The 19th Amendment ends disenfranchisement based on gender. Of course, unfortunately, you have almost 100 years after the Civil War where the 15th Amendment isn't worth the paper it's written on. You have large-scale disenfranchisement of Blacks in the former Confederate states through violence, through fraud, through mechanisms like poll taxes and literacy tests and the like. Post-1965, we again, in theory, get to an era where there aren't major bases for disenfranchisement. But even in the modern period, we have efforts continuing at voter suppression. They're not as aggressive, they're not as sweeping as some of the policies we've seen in the past. But because we allow elected, self-interested politicians to set the electoral rules, it's not really a surprise that politicians are tempted and often do manipulate those rules for their own advantage by making it harder for their opponents to vote. And so a common theme of the voting restrictions we've seen in recent years is that they're imposed by conservative legislatures targeting voters that are thought to be likely to vote for, you know, liberals and Democrats. Whether the restrictions actually work is another question, but the motive certainly seems to be helping to entrench these particular right-wing politicians by twisting the electorate through rules that are chosen to exclude. And so, you know, the struggle for full inclusion of all citizens in U.S. democracy definitely isn't over.
Well, and if I could just add to that, which I agree completely with, is that in the date 1965 is really important, because that's when the United States Congress passed the Voting Rights Act under Lyndon B. Johnson with the support of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders. And there was a critical provision of that. It was known as Section 5. And it essentially put the Justice Department on the block as police officers for these kind of cynical maneuvers to keep people from the ballot. And that was called preclearance. Essentially, if you were a bad actor state historically that were imposing these artificial barriers to voting, but weren't technically banning someone on the basis of race, but were effectively doing that, you'd have to get your new voter access laws by the Department of Justice. The Congress sort of renewed that act by large bipartisan majorities. parties multiple times. It was supposed to sunset. And then in a critical case in 2013 called Shelby County versus Holder, the United States Supreme Court struck down or essentially sort of decommissioned Section 5. So this is where, again, you have a constitutional implied or expressed now through the Supreme Court right to vote. You have an act of Congress. And then you have the Supreme Court coming in and striking that down, essentially saying, you know what, things are gotten so much better now. And by the way, your data is kind of old. So Congress, we want you to go back to the drawing board, prompting the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to sort of famously say, it's like saying your umbrella is working so well in a rainstorm, you might as well take it down. Even the majority in that case, the conservative majority in a 5-4 decision, agreed the Voting Rights Act was spectacularly successful in expanding access, legal access to the ballot. And since then, we have seen more of these encroachments creep back. And we might get to this, but there are two major pieces of legislation that have been pending for quite a while. One is H.R. 4. It's been renamed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act after Representative Lewis passed away. That is a law that would do exactly what the Supreme Court said Congress should do 8 years ago, and that is put Section 5 back in the Voting Rights Act, but we have, for a lot of reasons, a dysfunctional Congress, much more dysfunctional, I think, than we had even back in 2013. So that's languishing. And in addition, and again, we might get to this as well, I think this new 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court, this conservative majority, is probably more likely to be striking down acts of Congress to preserve the vote than progressives would like. And again, I think that is in part because the Constitution doesn't expressly enshrine the right to vote in an affirmative way that gives the court leeway, frankly, to tolerate or entertain justifications for ballot barriers that really don't have a whole lot of grounding in fraud or other sort of the other mainstream rationales people have for making it harder to vote.
And Nicholas, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind here is, you know, as somebody who follows, you know, these cases, but not a legal scholar, I'm familiar with the debates about judicial restraint versus judicial activism. And so the imagery would be the court, you know, enshrining this and this right to vote, and court shouldn't be doing that. Legislators, you know, should be. But in this case, it was the opposite, right? That the legislature had passed this law, and it was a pretty activist court decision to overturn the law and basically tell them you have to go back and rewrite the law. So I guess one question is, should we just throw out the notion of judicial restraint versus judicial activism in the assumption that, you know, the restraint is a conservative principle and activism is a liberal principle? And secondly, how much can we expect the courts to resolve this versus legislative action?
The current Supreme Court, I think, is not the friend of voting. It's not the friend of democracy. It's at best a bystander, and often it's closer to an enemy of voting and democracy. If you think about different roles the court could play, right, the court could step in and strike down voting restrictions. It could strike down partisan gerrymanders. It could strike down racially discriminatory measures. Earlier progressive courts did that. The Warren Court was famous for striking down voting restrictions, for making it easier for Americans to vote and promoting a fairer, more democratic political system. You could then imagine a truly restrained court. As Kimberly pointed out, there's no express right to vote in the Constitution. So we're not going to step in, but we're not going to, you know, hamper efforts by Congress or by state legislatures to promote democratic values. The Roberts Court doesn't do that either. The Roberts Court takes the affirmatively perverse approach of stepping in, you know, in a very unrestrained way to stop other actors from promoting democratic values. Shelby County is a great example of this. The Supreme Court stepping in and striking down one of the most important pro-democratic pieces of legislation that Congress has ever passed. But there are lots of other examples. So the court has struck down one limit on money in politics after another. You can barely count how many times the court has aggressively intervened to strike down campaign finance regulations. So I think it's really tragic that the court is not playing a pro-democratic role or even a neutral role but more and more is playing an anti-democratic role in our system.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing electoral law and the voter suppression campaign since the 2020 election with Nicholas Stephanopoulos of Harvard University and Kimberly Whaley of the University of Baltimore School of Law. And Kimberly, is it possible that those pieces of legislation, which are currently tied up in threats of filibuster and the inability to get 60 senators to consider the John Lewis Voting Act, is it possible that those could actually pass, but then the Supreme Court would overturn them?
Well, for sure. I mean, it's hard to say in the abstract, not knowing what they'll ultimately look like. My understanding is, you know, the Democrats in the Senate in particular are hunkering down to try to trim H.R. 1. So and we mentioned H.R. 4. H.R. 1 would be one of these sweeping federal bills relating to voting rights that technically under the Constitution only applies to federal elections, but as a practical matter, it trickles down to all elections because it's just so complicated and difficult to administer an election period that when the Congress says you should be able, for example, to register to vote at the DMV in your state, regardless of where you live. That's a federal law. And so H.R. 1 would do a lot of stuff, including around campaign finance and gerrymandering and other things that critics say it's just too ambitious. Critics say it's unfunded. But absolutely, I agree with the assessment that this court is not only neutral, but it's hostile towards voting rights. And you can look at the fractured split decision in Brnovich this term, which was kind of a bellwether, where Justice Alito essentially added a five-factor test to an act of Congress that doesn't exist. There is no five-factor test, and put this burden on voters that is increasingly hard to satisfy to show that their access to the ballot violates another part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. So Section 5 is sort of out of commission, so voters are going to Section 2. I won't go into that much detail, just except to point out that there was a time where Section 2 by courts was very sort of narrowly construed as requiring intentional discrimination, that you had to climb in the brains of state legislatures and show that they actually wanted to discriminate on the basis of race. For example, Congress amended that statute, said, no, we actually have a broader totality of the circumstances test. And so some would look at that, and I think it was Justice Kagan in her dissent said, listen, that shows that Congress really wanted this to do the work of making sure people can vote. And instead, Justice Alito, the conservative bloc, as I think you mentioned, tend to pretend, frankly, to be the ones that color inside the lines and don't, quote, legislate from the bench. And unfortunately, a lot of people believe that that are not legal scholars and don't understand vague language is vague, and it's all about interpretation. But he created this multi-factor test that acknowledges that there's disparate impact on race, that he basically tolerates that in the test, even though you could say clearly Congress didn't want that. So yeah, we are in a very sad moment when it comes to voting rights, in that, A, we have a Congress that absent the filibuster, getting rid of the filibuster, or maybe just tailoring it for voting rights. I know maybe Joe Manchin, Senator from West Virginia, suggested he's one of the holdouts on filibuster, that maybe he'd go along with tinkering with the filibuster. But if that doesn't get affected, then we're not going to see legislation. And even if we do, it could get struck down in the United States Congress, or at least amended in ways that don't reflect the people's will, because of course, members on the Supreme Court are not democratically elected and they're not removable through the democratic process, which is deeply, deeply problematic. And I want to put another, there's so much to talk about here, but I hope we do also have an opportunity to talk about the Electoral Count Act, because the other sort of forefront right now of the battle around voting rights is not so much who gets to cast a ballot, which is traditionally voter suppression laws, which are raging back, but whose ballots get counted. And as we saw with the 2020 election, with the January 6th insurrection, and triple digits of Republicans in this Congress refusing to gavel in Joe Biden, notwithstanding certified votes from the states, Secretary of State of Texas Attorney General Paxton of Texas filing a brief in the Supreme Court asking to cancel the votes in four other states, and 160 plus members of the United States Congress and signing onto that, and two justices, Alito and Justice Thomas, dissenting from the decision to not take that case. Where we're seeing now, the next frontier is, even if you get through all the hoops and you actually get your ballot cast, we're not going to count it. We're going to cancel it based on, you know, floating, effervescent, untethered allegations of voter fraud. And unless the Electoral Count Act is amended to require Congress and to acknowledge and respect, absent real evidence of fraud, the certifications from the states, and to require, frankly, the states after November to actually pay attention to the popular vote. Those are two big holes in this old statute. We could have the big lie in the next election, kind of, maybe the voters get to the polls and we get a good count, but the count gets ignored. And I fear that could be the end of American democracy, because then you're just ignoring votes. And there is no legislation, as to my knowledge, that's pending. HR 1 doesn't affect the counting of the votes versus the casting of the votes. And HR 4 does not affect the counting of the votes versus the casting of the votes. And the time for addressing that is between now and 2022, when there are midterms that could decide who controls both houses of Congress.
And that kind of raises that question about how much we relied on norms, because nobody had ever thought to challenge that and not necessarily having those legal protections. I'm certainly going to come back to that, but there's one thing I want to really make sure to address. And Nicholas, I know you've actually written on this question. There was one thing that made the 2020 election unique with respect to allegations of fraud or questions of process, and that's the pandemic. Initially, the challenges against the state seemed to be pandemic-driven, that states were expanding access to the ballot with things like the drop boxes and the and mail-in balloting, et cetera, with the pretty express purpose that we're in the middle of a pandemic and people want to be able to stay at home but still be able to vote. Now, that doesn't necessarily seem to be at the core of the campaign now, but early, in the 2020 process, that seemed to be a part of this. How much has this issue really been exacerbated because we're living in this historic pandemic that required some degree of flexibility for access to the ballot?
A lot of voting changes happened during the pandemic in all kinds of directions. Some states, some municipalities decided to make voting easier. Some states passed things like universal absentee ballots for everybody, or at least universal absentee ballot applications for everybody. States set up drop boxes in larger volumes than before. We saw things like curbside voting and mobile voting centers to make it easier to vote without coming into contact with other people and potentially infecting them. And so there was a big surge in 2020 in non-in-person voting, either early voting or mail-in voting of one kind or another. And so, a couple points about that. One is that there was a big surge, but it was still largely the continuation of existing trends. It's not like in 2016, everyone voted in person. I forget the exact numbers, but I think something like a third of all voting or more was not done in person on election day in 2016. And that number may have gone to well above half in 2020, but it was still a very large number before. The other point is that for the defeated, for Trump, who lost the election, he was looking for things to blame for his defeat. And one narrative is that either these voting relaxations caused a lot of fraud, which supposedly enabled Biden to win, or at the very least, these relaxations made voting easier, and that enabled a lot more legitimate votes to be cast, and that may have contributed to Biden's victory. The fraud story is just a lie. As Kimberly pointed out, there's just no evidence of systematic widespread fraud on anything close to the level necessary to decide a presidential election. Even the other narrative is pretty much wrong. The best evidence we have is that higher turnout, voting relaxations like mail-in voting or more early voting, don't have a significant partisan effect. politicians seem to think they have a big effect, but the best evidence is that they cause higher turnout from both sides without giving either party a big advantage. So when I think about the voting relaxations of 2020 and the effort to now roll back some of those relaxations, you know, the rollback effort is built on a lie about fraud, and it's also built on just an erroneous understanding of how voting restrictions and voting relaxations work. They don't really seem to have big partisan effects on the ground. And so, you know, that has implications for both sides. It means that the Republicans who are pushing these restrictions for partisan gain, which I think is basically all of them, should expect to be disappointed. They're probably not going to dramatically change the partisan landscape through these rollbacks. And then Democrats were worried that Georgia or Texas's voting restrictions might entrench Republican power forever in those states. That's probably also a bit of an exaggerated concern. You know, most likely these restrictions are not going to have a significant effect on either party's performance in those states.
And Kimberly, one fact that has been established is a lot more people voted in 2020 than even in 2016. The former president likes to say, you got more votes in 2020, so how did he lose? And the answer was, of course, because a lot more people voted. I always assumed it was because of the polarizing nature of his presidency. He got a lot of people who weren't terribly interested in politics, much more interested. But with that in mind, are these campaigns to restrict voting just kind of a political backlash against any significant expansion of voting, kind of a, you know, two steps forward, one step back? Whenever you see an increase in voting, a potential democratization of voting, is there a large lesson that when more people vote, the people who had voted previously are going to be upset and they're going to try to figure out a way to keep them from voting?
As we said earlier, this is an old story. It goes back to the founding of the Republic, keeping the tent as closed as possible to new voters. But I think the story in part that's missing from this whole discussion is the success of this 2020 election with the thousands and thousands of regular Americans who came out in a pandemic, not just to vote, but to make these elections actually work and function. And what we're seeing, in addition to limitations on access to the ballot, are new laws being passed to penalize election workers, both criminally and with huge fines, for making good faith mistakes, doing, you know, when it's almost like having a wedding reception in a pandemic when you don't have a budget and you have no idea who's coming. I mean, these are not easy things to pull off. And of course, no one's complaining about down ballot fraud. They're only saying the fraud somehow happened at the top of the ticket. But to answer your question, I think a couple things to pay attention to. This new census data came out this week, and we'd already known, there's already statistics showing that, you know, more than 50% of Americans under the age of 16 are of color. The white population in this country is shrinking. And the Republican Party, I really call it the revised Republican Party or the alt Republican Party, because it's certainly not the traditional Republican Party of Lincoln, but the one now that is really anti-democratic, is not running on any meaningful policy platforms. They're running on fear. They're running on sort of implied and sometimes expressed racism. And the idea certainly is, how do we stay in power? We stay in power by morphing into single party rule and limiting access to the ballot. And this is something that I think all Americans, regardless of political stripe, really should care about. It's hard to get that message across, both because of misinformation online and because there are just lots of suffering going on for lots of reasons, make people sort of have emotional reactions to a lot of this stuff. The politicians play on that. But, you know, we've seen in our lifetime in other parts of the world, functioning democracies fail and turn into, you know, fake democracies that are only that on paper. And unfortunately, at least in my lifetime, I don't think we've ever seen what's happening now. It's not just a fight over voter IDs, which was really the fight a few years ago, which frankly Congress could fix by just issuing everybody a federal ID if you're a citizen. I don't know why we can't just get one little clean thing through Congress, and then that whole argument would go away, because or people that are not documented wouldn't have access to that. But we're really, I think what we're having right now, Douglas is a debate as to whether we want democracy, where the people pick their leaders, or we want something else, where the people in power pick who stays in power. And it's not being framed that way. It's still being framed as a choice between, you know, blue party platform and our party platform. But the Republican platform in the last round was non-existent. All it was adherence to Donald Trump, period, the person. You know, when I say this to people, people get really afraid, and I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but as my colleague understands as a scholar, this is where things are pointing, and we don't have any sort of entitlement to a functioning democracy. We have to all come out in 2022 and vote for the right to vote and be our own bosses in government. And that's not a given in this moment.
Nicholas, I keep hearing this from the, you know, coming out of, you know, Democratic Party activists, that the way you overcome some of these challenges is you're going to have to organize. So in essence, to save the democracy, we need more democracy. It needs to be political organization and get out the vote campaigns in order to ensure that these, that advocates of decreasing the access to the ballot are going to lose the next election. How much confidence should we have that this is really the best way forward? We just need a lot more Democrats, a lot more people of color, a lot more people just concerned with this issue voting, especially considering the fact that well over 50% of the votes cast in several elections have gone to Democrats, but they frequently don't win.
Greater organization, greater mobilization can help with respect to voting restrictions. The idea for most modern voting restrictions is not to categorically disenfranchise any category of people. It's to make it more of a hassle to vote, you know, to eat up more of your time, to make it more of a headache, make you wait in line, make you find forms, make you find a notary, et cetera. So greater organization, you know, greater initiative can help to overcome those kinds of efforts that are driving up the cost of voting. But more mobilization isn't going to help at all with the voters, the election subversion tactics that Kimberly mentioned. If the Georgia state legislature takes over the Fulton County Election Board and then simply tosses out a bunch of lawfully cast ballots, you know, all the mobilization in the world isn't going to stop the discarding of the ballots that are the product of the mobilization. And then when it comes to, you know, gerrymandering, rejiggering the boundaries of districts, you know, you can mobilize all you want. The extra votes are just going to be useless in the packed Democratic districts. You know, they're going to result in the Democrat winning 90-10, not 80-20, but big deal. That's no more seats in the legislature. In the crack districts, it's, you know, hard, bordering on impossible to make up a, you know, 5 percentage point, 10 percentage point intentional disadvantage in a district through mobilization. So, you know, I think we have to distinguish between different kinds of anti-democratic practices. Mobilization can help. It's not a cure, but it can help with voting restrictions, but it's effectively useless against gerrymandering and against election subversion. And it's also a little offensive to poor voters, minority voters, Democrats in general, to tell them, hey, you're going to go have to work twice as hard to cast the same number of votes. You know, if you're an old white Republican, we'll kowtow to your every need. We'll make voting a walk in the park. But if you're somebody else, we're going to make you jump through one hoop after another. That's frankly offensive. Like, the government should be treating its citizens equally when it comes to voting. So I think even if mobilization can succeed, it's still, I think, offensive and undemocratic to obligate one group of people to mobilize where other groups of people don't have to mobilize to effectively cast their ballots.
It's a reminder that, to me, one of the greatest things we can do and simplest things we can do to try to ensure greater access to the ballot is just give everybody Election Day off. The fact that we are one of the rare democracies that vote on a day where everybody has to go to work has always been something that I thought was remarkably classist, certainly, you know, racist at that point. Thank you both very much for your insights into this, the challenges that we face with this question of voter suppression, some of the legal challenges, some of the political challenges. We've been discussing the voter suppression campaigns, state legislatures making it more difficult to access the ballot and the implications on the democracy. Our guests today have been Nicholas Stephanopoulos. He is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and the author of The New Vote Dilution, Election Litigation in the Time of the Pandemic, and Depoliticizing Redistricting. And Kimberly Whaley, she's the Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and the author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why, and How to Read the Constitution and Why. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
When we come back, mining the bottom of the sea for minerals. What are the repercussions? And how can we prevent devastating fragile ecosystems in the ocean? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The world's thirst for more minerals has corporations and others now turning to mine a region of the world that had previously been left relatively undisturbed, the ocean floor. What might the ramifications of mining the deep sea be on the ocean's ecosystem health? What precautions should be taken to prevent devastating the fragile ecosystems? With us are two experts. Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada research chair in deep ocean research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe.
This new exploration of deep sea mining, there seems to be conflicting thoughts about this. On one hand, we could be severely damaging the ocean ecosystems in ways that we don't understand. On the other, I understand these metals are sort of needed for a renewable revolution. So are we just trading one environmental disaster for another?
First of all, I want to say that I'm a scientist and I'm not for or against mining, but I think everybody that's involved, all stakeholders, need to know the consequences of activities that are undertaken, for example, in the deep ocean for deep sea mining. And it's pretty clear that deep sea mining, especially for polymetallic nodules or manganese nodules, as they are also called, will have a major environmental footprint. It'll cause substantial damage over thousands to hundreds of thousands of kilometers of seafloor. So the environmental impacts will be major, and the changes, the harm to the ecosystems will be permanent, essentially, because there are organisms that live nowhere else but on these nodules on the bottom of the ocean. And when you take them away, it takes millions of years for them to grow. Now, if we step back and look at things on a global scale, society may decide that it is worth these environmental costs to mine these metals from the seafloor for electric vehicle batteries, et cetera. But that's not a judgment I can make. I can't really judge the economics and environmental impacts in other ecosystems, but I can judge what they will be in the deep sea. And it's important to recognize that they will be substantial.
Well, let's talk about the deep sea for a moment. So I've been looking at some of your papers, and it says that we've got really a huge amount of the world's ocean there, volume representing the largest and least explored biome on Earth. What can you tell us about what we have studied to date and what we know about this part of the planet in the ocean?
What we do know about the deep sea is that it's very heterogeneous. There are lots of different kinds of habitats and different kinds of biodiversity. For example, hydrothermal vents are one very remarkable type of ecosystem where there are giant tube worms and all kinds of novel organisms adapted to this extreme environment. And we also have other kinds of habitats like seamounts that are very different from hydrothermal vents or from nodule fields and different biodiversity. And the nodule fields themselves are really unusual, radically different from other parts of the deep sea. And they have also very high biodiversity and a huge list of undescribed species that are new to science. Most of the species we haven't collected, and those that we have collected are new to science. So, and we can say that the deep sea in general harbors remarkable biodiversity and lots of different ecosystems, but we still are very early on in characterizing this biodiversity.
So for those of us who are not marine biologists or marine ecologists, what are all these critters you've just been talking about?
Well, some of them are giant tube worms that are a couple meters long. There are lots of different kinds of worms, polychaete worms that have amazing adaptations. I mean, some of them don't look like worms at all. They look like big orange floating animals, balloons. And then there are lots of different kinds of crustaceans and actually quite a high diversity of deep sea fishes.
Farina?
What are the animals? They are denizens of the deep that we never see further up. For us living on land, they represent the inhabitants of an alien world that seems to be totally unconnected with us. And yet, we're talking about ecosystems that have adapted to their environment for millennia after millennia. So there's an intrinsic value in these bizarre things, which us scientists give all sorts of wonderful names to. You can create stories about each one of these little critters, and I love the little stories, but so what? The so what really comes in the concept of the deep ocean being an integrated part of our planet that we're only just understanding. Whereas humans have had impact for tens to hundreds of thousands of years on the land, we haven't really got there much in the deep ocean. It's getting there. We're starting to affect the deep sea. But this is a place that has yet to really feel the full hammer of human ambition. And why these ecosystems might matter to us is part of that whole connectedness. So, for example, the ocean serves as a huge sink for the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere. And the biggest reservoir of carbon dioxide on our planet is in the deep ocean. It's being pulled down. And so one of the services these ecosystems do for us is processing our foolishness in putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So there's things they do for us. There's ways in which our food production is connected to the deep sea. So if one believes in the ecosystems of the planet working together, these do represent our most furthest ones and the ones we know the least about. But for that very reason, those knowledge gaps and stepping carefully becomes really important.
So Verena Tunnicliffe, we opened the conversation about this juxtaposition between the drive to renewable energy, which is part of why they're driving to mine in the deep ocean, to stop putting carbon dioxide into the air, and yet the possibility of trading one ecological disaster for another, and whether that deep sea mining is just going to be so irreparable that it's kind of counter affects the good that might come from getting those minerals. Do you have a sense of that?
I have a sense of the question. It's a risk analysis one makes. And one interesting question is it going to make any difference in the long run? Partly the place I'm going is that I'm not sure we're going to change anything with land-based mining, for one thing. Simply because if it's there, we're going to go for it. For feeding the renewables market, one issue is if we keep feeding the same minerals into it and making access to the minerals, are we curbing the innovations that will begin to wean us off the need for those particular minerals? I mean, I'm not a technologist in terms of how batteries work, but I do understand there are other potential ways of building batteries. There are other potential kinds of energy resources. So at what point do we stop and think about how we work in terms of needing or using those metals versus, okay, here's another source, so let's just go for it? Are we having the right social discussion? And it is time to include humankind. This is the heritage of humankind on the seafloor. That's part of the law of the sea. And so perhaps the social conversation needs to happen to understand all aspects of it.
And part of that discussion needs to be a really objective assessment of what the impact of mining will be. A major issue is that I'm absolutely convinced that the potential impacts of mining are being minimized. They're being glossed over because most of the general public doesn't know enough about the deep sea to realize that some of the statements about what these impacts will be like are just unrealistic and purposely naive, I think.
So what should the public know?
I think the public should know, for example, I'm particularly specialist on manganese nodule ecosystems and what mining impacts will be, that these are, number one, the most pristine habitats on the planet. Yes, there are some microplastics make it down there, but in general, these are the largest, you know, habitat areas of wilderness left on the planet. And they also are among the most stable and probably the least resilient to human disturbances of any ecosystem. For example, mining will inevitably raise a sediment plume or resuspend sediment and put it up in the water column. And the Clipperton-Clarion Zone has the clearest bottom waters on the planet, clearer than anywhere else in the ocean. They're so clear that their bottom waters are clear, there's less suspended sediment or particles than in the clear surface waters of the ocean. If you go in the middle of the most nutrient-poor oceans, the water is not as clear as it is in the bottom of the Clipperton-Clarion Zone. So what that tells you is these communities are adapted to very low concentrations of sediment particles. They have all kinds of adaptations that rely, that are dependent on these conditions. And so when you perturb this ecosystem by resuspending large plumes of sediment, you'll bury animals, you interfere with their ability to respire, you'll smother them, not just animals, but also microbes or bacteria, et cetera. And also, most of the animals in the deep sea use light in their ecology. They create light. And sediment plumes will black this out. It'll be dark clouds of sediment preventing organisms from finding mates, from finding prey, etc. So these are very stable ecosystems in the Clipperton-Clarion Zone. They're targeted for nodule mining, and they also have really high diversity, some of the highest diversities of seafloor communities anywhere in the ocean. And we don't really know why. We know that that's true, but we don't know what processes are driving that.
Verena Tunnicliffe, would you add anything to that?
I think I'd love the public to know a little bit about the ecosystem that I love in the deep sea, which is hydrothermal hot vents. And the particular issue here is that the hot vent ecosystem has its own group of species that live there. They're not found anywhere else in the world. And we've learned so much about the origin of life and life's adaptations in really extreme circumstances, to the point where the lessons from hydrothermal vents are now driving exploration in outer space. That's how fundamental the discoveries have been. And yet the size of these ecosystems is tiny. Unlike what Craig is talking about, fairly large areas in the abyss, the hydrothermal vents cluster around these tiny hot springs, which also form the deposits of interest to miners. And animals are living on those deposits. Now, when we estimate the total area of hydrothermal vents in the world, we've got something that's maybe 30 to 50 square kilometers. That's it. That's tiny. Think of Central Park in New York City or some small island in the Caribbean. That's the total area. We are told that miners probably won't want to go next to near hot water. So that's great. I love to hear that. But we must put them under protection, officially under protection. If indeed they aren't going to mine them, and they do recognize that they're special, then they have to be entrenched in the regulations, and we're not quite hearing that discussion happening. So that's one of the three resources that's being targeted.
So in these vents that you're talking about, you said the critters are living on the deposits that have the very minerals that these companies and societies are therefore after.
The same is true on the nodules with their own critters growing on them. The same is true on the cobalt crusts on the seamounts. So on the seamounts, tops of seamounts, we have the ancient corals, we have the sponges, we have a diverse community that is on, I mean, you've got to remove the substratum and therefore the habitat's gone. And so for most of these habitats, the formation of that substratum has taken thousands to millions of years.
And one of the key things, and this is the way nature works, when you have a specialized habitat or a specialized set of conditions that produce a mineral resource, that's also a specialized habitat. So where you find minerals that are remarkably rich in metals that can be used in batteries on the seafloor anywhere, it's going to be a different kind of ecosystem than places that don't have those minerals. And so you have specially adapted communities. And so you can't harvest a remarkable and unusual resource on the seafloor without damaging an unusual community. That's how life works. That's how evolution works.
And then if they do end up damaging that community, what you are saying is that we don't really know the repercussions that might trickle beyond that, the interconnection of the ecosystems.
Yep.
Marina, I see you nodding.
Yep. You think about things on land which have been, you know, removed for lifetimes, many, many people's lifetimes, and how mountain, you know, alpine regions have completely changed, or you've changed something over to agriculture and you've lost completely the original ecosystems. I mean, to some extent, we don't even know how much we've already changed life on land. So with the removal of the fundamental habitat, you are not going to see a quick reforestation or whatever you want, or restoration of the communities that are gone. And so part of the problem here is just understanding the ramifications of that and trying to model what that might look like when you have no baseline.
So what can we propose that might protect to some degree if they are determined to start mining in the oceans? How can we conserve what is necessary to protect life, protect biodiversity, protect the potential ripple effects to the rest of the planet?
There are a variety of approaches. One fundamental approach to protecting biodiversity and ecosystem functions is to protect enough of the ecosystems in the area that are being exploited, put them in no mining areas or marine protected areas so that you maintain biodiversity and the ecosystem functions, the services that are provided by that region. And that's being done to some degree and for nodule mining, and it's in the planning stages for mining of massive sulfides, the extinct vents. But that's just one thing. Spatial management is really important. Another thing that I think is really clearly important is what a lot of scientists call the precautionary approach, that you assume the worst reasonable scenario and you plan, you manage for that until you can show otherwise, and in fact the scale of impacts are less than the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And so my feeling for manganese nodule mining is that in space and time scales of impacts are so poorly known that I really a responsible way to proceed with mining would be to start with one mining operation and really study it for the decades or so required to get a full understanding of the scales of impact. And if we see that it's enormous and it's really threatening biodiversity and ecosystem services in the whole area, then we stop at one. But if we see we can scale up from that. And I think most scientists would agree that one mining operation, the Clipton Clarion Zone, and probably one mining of an operation of a massive sulfide, if done properly with appropriate mitigation measures, et cetera, probably is not going to cause large-scale damage to the ocean and to biodiversity. So we probably can do it on a small scale and get an understanding of what the real ramifications are. Maybe Marina can comment. But I think that's really important, the precautionary approach, that we proceed carefully one step at a time rather than just allowing large-scale mining to occur in lots of different places at lots of simultaneously.
So where are the contracts that you know about? Where are they proposing to start mining?
Well, there are 16 in the Clipperton Clarion Zone, each of them up to 75,000 square kilometers. And then there are a number of other, they're called reserve areas, that are reserved for mining by developing nations or by the International Seabed Authority itself, the regulatory body that regulates mining in areas at the seabed and areas beyond national jurisdiction. And then Verena can comment on how many. There are some claim, I've forgotten exactly how many, I think it's six, that are on seamount systems, seamount cobalt systems.
Yes, there are five or six. And those are mostly in the Western Pacific between Wake Island and Guam. And then there's one off Brazil, and those are for seamounts. And then there's an additional seven for hydrothermal vents, four in the Atlantic, and at least three in the Indian Ocean, which is a place we have very little exploration.
Which are the minerals that they are most after?
The metals that make the most economic drivers are nickel and cobalt. Those are the two big ones. And then you can make money from the copper and the manganese. And then there's other metals that can come out of them. Mm. The nodules are of particular interest because they have such a high concentration. And that there isn't a whole lot of extra processing you have to do once you've got it through a processing plant.
I think gold is also a mineral of interest for the massive sulfides.
Yes, it is. Depends on the deposit. You aren't going to get a lot of gold out of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge sulfides.
Well, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe, I thank you both so very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Your interest.
Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada Research Chair in Deep Ocean Research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers. Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.